This is the BBC.
What has happened to the much vaunted parity of esteem for mental and physical health, trumpeted as an objective by successive governments and by high-profile politicians keen to emphasise their compassionate credentials? Well, one answer, perhaps a little pessimistic, if not downright cynical, is that given the parlous state of the National Health Service, neither side of this Cartesian divide any longer wishes for such an equivalence, since it implies a race to the bottom, not the top. In contemporary Britain, it no longer matters whether what ails you is a physical or a mental malady, or a combination of the both. The social safety net is now too frayed to catch you when you fall. Another point that needs to be made is that in common with so many of our collective drives towards greater economic assistance for and inclusion of the most vulnerable and least advantaged in our society, this one has been spearheaded by wealthy celebrities who, for all their willingness to lay bare their troubled souls, are hardly representative of the stigmas and abuses visited on their less fortunate fellow sufferers. It's difficult to think of anyone in the public eye receiving the sort of treatment that a friend of mine underwent during the summer while detained under Section 2 of the Mental Health Act at a London psychiatric hospital. After I visited her for the first time, a mutual friend asked me what it was like on one of these locked wards, and I said, "Well, you know that film, One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest?" Shocked, the mutual friend interrupted, "You mean complete with sadistic Nurse Ratched, administering drugs, electroconvulsive therapy and even lobotomies without the patient's consent?" And I replied that yes, this is pretty much what I meant, although for the most part, actual psychosurgery is now off the menu. This, together with the infinitely depressing ambience created where run-down institutional architecture intersects with acute mental distress. To stand in the corridor of a crowded, locked ward in a contemporary British mental hospital is still to feel oneself closer to Hogarth's hellish vision of bedlam than any enlightened healthcare, as patients in various states of mania and psychosis volubly act out. In such an environment, everyone is self-evidently a suitable case for treatment that most often takes the form of that loathsome euphemism, restraint, as flying squads of hypodermic-wielding nurses and psychiatrists subdue one or other of the patients whose behaviour has become too flamboyant or violent or both. Which is not to suggest for a moment that the hard-pressed staff generally, or those specifically who ministered to my unhappy friend, are sadists like Nurse Ratched. Yet the facts are that during an episode which lasted 3 weeks, she was subjected to a precipitate police intervention, misdiagnosis, the heavy-handed administration of inappropriate and indeed contraindicated drugs, while a series of bureaucratic failures saw her shuffled from one institution to another, including a sojourn on a geriatric ward. She's in her 50s. My friend's initial request to see an independent mental health advocate, a statutory right for all those detained in this way, was met with the response, "He's on holiday." Thus, it wasn't until, prompted by me, my friend contacted a solicitor and gave notice she'd be formally challenging the section, that she was, in short order, re-diagnosed by another psychiatrist, allowed out unsupervised, despite still being sectioned, and then, in a matter of days, released back into the community with no mandated aftercare or support at all. Not that my friend wanted any more of the treatment she'd been given for her alleged bipolar condition, a pair of so-called atypical antipsychotics, drugs which, besides having an array of unpleasant side effects from sexual dysfunction to weight gain, have, in the jargon, no clear mechanism of action. That's right, my vulnerable friend, diagnosed in a consultation that she told me lasted less than 5 minutes, was then made to take drugs that made her feel and act like a zombie. My friend has a mordant wit and observed to me how bizarre it is that successive generations of psychiatric drugs, no matter what their stated effects, nevertheless all make those who take them act as if they're mentally ill. Risperidone, one of the drugs my friend was obliged to swallow, lest she be given it by injection, has as a common side effect the potentially permanent movement disorder, tardive dyskinesia, which consists of repetitive involuntary actions such as sticking the tongue out, working the jaw, writhing and jerking of the limbs. It's strange indeed, and surely non-coincidental, that previous generations of psychiatric drugs also made many of those who took them twitch and kick out at the world. When I spoke to one of the psychiatrists charged with caring for my friend, he observed that since she'd been taking the drugs, she'd become calmer and less distressed. When I pointed out that although this improvement may have been correlated with taking the drugs, that in itself didn't mean they'd caused it, he became defensive, saying I had no authority to question his professional expertise. But from what I've seen, the professional expertise of psychiatrists to a large extent consists in little more than consulting a checklist of symptoms, trying to identify some of them in a given patient, and then mandating this or that drug, the action of which, as we've already noted, is as occult as the treatments favoured by earlier generations of soul doctors, whether they were the removal of portions of the patient's brain or the artificial induction of a severe bout of malaria. My friend is an unhappy woman, traumatized by a neglected and abusive childhood, who in adult life, without any family or effective support network, has found it difficult to cope. The problems she faces would, I've no doubt, be amenable to and effectively ameliorated by good talking therapy, combined with far less economic insecurity. Another way of looking at it is that my friend, who's an intelligent, creative, and highly empathetic individual, would be much happier in a small and supportive community rather than a large and, for the most part, indifferent society. Successive public health campaigns have sought to shift the focus of healthcare to prevention from cure. But while the strident campaigns enjoining good physical health are all around us in the form of reams of rules regarding health and safety at work, where are the campaigns and measures directed at preventing poor mental health? True, we're constantly urged to minimize our stress, but there's hardly a blanket ban on those things, such as acute financial anxiety, that are implicated in my friend's condition and those of millions of others. Instead, we have the treatments indicated by the so-called biological model of mental illness. Antidepressants for those who are depressed, taken voluntarily until they become too hysterically miserable, whereupon they're sectioned and given much stronger drugs. How paradoxical it is that the main way we try to achieve this elusive parity of esteem for mental illness is by applying these very crude and very physical nostrums. Of course, it's impossible for clinicians to prescribe community or for politicians to legislate for it while we remain wedded to our current philosophy of financial profit as the measure of all human worth. But it isn't only a matter of economic unsustainability. There's also our own deep-seated fear and anxiety in reaction to mental distress. Faced with someone who cannot tell what's real and what's not, or who responds vocally to the captious voices no one but they can hear, or who rises up into dizzy fugues of ebullience only to spiral back down into catatonic torpor, we don't merely walk the other way, we run. But just as the lame or the blind may require a helping hand, so the human touch is essential for those beset by seemingly invisible demons. It isn't until we're all able to manifest such esteem for the mentally ill that we'll see any real change in their treatment. The only reason the mentally ill are warehoused out of our sight and subjected to arbitrary treatments is because of the distressing spectacle they present. The paradox is that if we were prepared to accept this spectacle, it would almost certainly become less distressing. For them, and for us, both.